informed as to what's going on in their neighborhood. And I understand, based on that talk, that this week it hit 1 million users. And much of that is because of the unhinged reaction by the Trump administration, where he has been threatened, his wife has been fired from her job, and all kinds of hell that nobody should have to go through he is experiencing right now. So it was a real real honor to have somebody like that be a part of that gathering, and to just see the reaction, to see people wake up to all this. And any thoughts from you guys on that particular talk or any other talk?
Yeah, the reaction to it was really interesting, because some folks were really into it. Some folks got caught up in criticizing like the ways in which he chose to do certain things. But the dialogue is important to have, and all in all, it's all helping to get the issue that this is all about more fully addressable in the public sphere. And I don't think there's any underestimating the importance of that.
I saw some of that disagreement, and you know, in the hacker world, everyone's going to have a different opinion on how an app should be written, how data should be stored or not stored. And of course, one of the big issues is that this is only available on iPhones. It does not work on Android. And there are all kinds of reasons we won't get into here. We've already gotten into them in a previous show, and he gets into it very much in detail at his two-hour talk. But, you know, the disagreements and the suggestions, they were all done really respectfully. And I was impressed by that. That's why I say these were such awesome people. I include everybody, you know, the attendees as well as the speakers, because we were able to listen to each other, disagree, and just enjoy each other's company, whether virtual or in person.
And I got to say, that kind of fits the vibe of the whole weekend, too, because I think folks knew that it was all the more important, perhaps more than ever before in this event's history, to all pull together and do everything we could to have it go smoothly. I heard good things from the folks I knew who were doing security and other sort of wrangling from you guys and others, and just the smoothness with which things went. And the event itself ended up just being really, really impressive and comfortable, and it felt safe.
Alex, any thoughts? Alex, you there?
Yeah, okay. I think I had a great time. I think there is this very vibrant, you know, grassroots feeling to hope that is really missing at a whole bunch of other conferences that are either too large now or too corporate focused. Like this conference, to me, always since I went to the first one in 1994 when I was a teenager, I was 15 at that one. This one has always fostered this real true sense of community and a really true sense of collaboration. And I've loved it. And one of my highlights of the entire weekend at Hope was meeting up with people that I haven't seen in many, many years that showed up. People from, you know, 20 years ago that have showed up and said, hey, I've been out of the scene for a little while. Now I'm here again. And just to see how inspired they were by being back at Hope after some time really re-energized me as well. And I think in that spirit and in that vein, on Saturday night, along with two colleagues of mine, Phil Dian and Harry Halpin, we had a talk at 8 p.m. that was about fostering the sense of community between the hacker culture and the hacker subculture and the Ethereum and blockchain subcultures, which are two cultures, I think, that share very much the same ethos and the same vision, but have been historically divided for some years without really any, I think, real explanation for it. There's prejudices that have been bandied about from both cultures. And what we were there to do is to try to bridge that gap. And we called it bridging the decentralized gap. And that talk was just so well received. It was hard to extricate ourselves from all the many conversations that we had with the attendees after that talk, because we were able to demonstrate that, look, the hacker culture and, you know, the real builders from the Ethereum and the blockchain worlds have that same vision. And we're all talking about the same tech, and we're relying on the same tech in the Ethereum world that the hacker culture fought for, bled for, and died for back in the 90s. And I'm talking about things like asymmetric public key cryptography, on which the Ethereum culture is built, and the same kind of shared values with respect to promotion of open source, building out in public, keeping things accountable, auditability, transparency, all these things that I think we were able to bring to the forefront. And that was just so well received because of the sense of community within the HOPE conference.
I thought that particularly with this this disagreement that was talked about in Josh's talk, it was coming from a place of love. Like, everybody wants the stuff to work and be safe for everyone. There's just different ways about going about it. And I think each side of whatever, quote, disagreement is really just trying to create understanding about their way of thinking about it. And because they both care, what I see in that discussion about something technical or a choice that's made in something is people care very deeply about this issue. Like, it's not that there's one way to go about it necessarily, or that one way is perfect. Regardless of that, people want to figure it out. And that really applies to so many of the other talks that there were in general. But anyway, it's good to see people being complimentary and enjoying something, but also having insight. And that's the kind of way you innovate.
Absolutely, yes. And it's just this spirit of rebellion that I think has always been part of the hacker culture and, you know, culture in general. And I just saw this before coming on the air. It's not attributed. It's one of these things that is being passed around on social media. But it's talking about ICE raids in Los Angeles. And you realize that they can't win because they're not clever enough. And the people that we know, these cool people that we get to hang out with every now and then, they are clever enough. They are positive enough. They're imaginative enough. Listen to this. LA has been and continues to protest against ICE. These protests haven't gotten any smaller or lost any momentum, but social media wasn't reflecting it. TikTok users, realizing that the platform / other social media were censoring, deleting, and shadow banning these protest videos, well, they decided to find a workaround. They're calling it the LA Music Festival. ICE detention centers and other protest locations are stages. The hottest band is Rage Against the Machine. Here's what gear you should be bringing to stay safe at the LA Music Festival. And it worked. TikTok has become a proving ground for a lot of new music, meaning lots of labels and organizations have lucrative deals with TikTok to promote their new artists and music festivals. So they absolutely cannot censor the words music festival or train the algorithm to ignore it, or they risk endangering that very important revenue. So now protest videos are flooding feeds again, but it's the LA 24/7 Music Festival. Truly an incredible timeline we've landed in. That, folks, is how you win.
Fully, yeah. I love that tactic. Just, you have to mix it up. Don't be what's expected in making choices like that. It's really simple. I love that. That's like very clever. Just turn it around, make it function and in a way that it confuses authority, right?
Absolutely, yes. Gila, looks like you have something to say.
Oh, gosh, yes. No, absolutely. I mean, I was... The spirit and the vibe all weekend was really lovely. And the person with whom I attended the most talks likes to sit in the very front of the room. So it was interesting to be right up near all of the speakers and then to hear everything coming from behind us. It was a wonderful thing to see all weekend. I vastly enjoyed it. And But not on that topic, talking about ICE stuff, it's also been nice to see the number of mobilizations that are happening, especially around the Delmarva area, as people are kind of pulling together to just kind of surround ICE and stop them from what they're doing. I appreciate that too.
Absolutely. And it all ties in. These things matter. And the reason we talk about it so much is because our country is going through something it's never gone through before. And here at BAI, we take that kind of thing very, very seriously. And we have a large number of people that can address these topics with all manner of expertise. So it's a station well worth listening to, well worth supporting, and making sure that it's defended against whatever threats are lying in wait. What's happening to PBS and NPR is atrocious, obviously, but it affects all of community radio, and certainly WBAI is in the forefront of that. So whatever you can manage to donate to WBAI, please go to givetowbai.org. Did I get that right? Givetowbai.org. Okay, I'm sorry. There's so many websites. Buddy.wbai.org. Pledge whatever you can afford. Pledge a monthly amount. You know, if you pledge $30 a month, that's $1 a day. That's $1 a day. Are we worth $1 a day? I think this radio station, which maintains this the spirit of rebellion, which does not cave, which survives all kinds of challenges from within and from without, and has been doing so since 1960. Again, we'll match any other radio station that has done something like that. That's worth $1 a day. I would say that's worth $2 a day, you know? And to have something like that, to know that you can turn on the radio and, you know, hear something, you won't always agree, you won't always like it, but it's going to be there. It's not going to be intimidated and threatened and basically silenced, like so many things are being silenced these days. I mean, you know, we're talking about radio stations being sold now because they can't afford to continue operating without CPB funding, which Trump is taking away. We have those stations turning literally to religion. Because if they sell the station, who's going to buy it? Obviously, a religious group is going to buy it because they qualify for a non-commercial radio license. It's sad, it's pathetic, and it's bad for democracy and freedom of speech. And that's something that we need to stand up for, and we need to fight that. So your support anytime is appreciated. Again, give to WBAI.org, buddy.wbai.org. Those are the websites to go to support this radio station. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that struck me about so many of the talks and workshops at HOPE this past weekend was so many of them are about individuals and groups who saw a problem that needed solving and figured a way to, here's a way for the solution to that to come from the community, to come from us, to come from folks who are interested in doing it, because the help is just not out there. They have to be the ones who help. And this station is an amazing example of just that. This station is here because the people listening to it and the people who have been keeping it going since 1960. That's 65 years of this just because of you there listening. And those of you who can, going to buddy.wbai.org or calling 833-WBAI-NYC, that's 833-922-4692, and throwing in what you can to help keep the lights on, to help keep us all doing what we're doing. None of us are being paid. This is a volunteer operation. This is the only reason it happens. It's because of you. It's because of your help.
That's right. Go ahead, Alex.
One of the things I want to echo here, too, is that, this was a special one, a special HOPE conference for me. That is because I got to do a lot of things that I didn't ordinarily do. And one of those things was to MC a lot of the talks. And that was very sadly because our friend Greg couldn't make it over to New York. Greg Newby, who usually is over there and emceeing a lot of the talks. So I stepped in and helped. And I'll tell you, I had a hell of a lot of fun doing that. It was really, I think, it just made the weekend a lot different to me from any other hope, from the other 15 of them. And I got to introduce talks from Joseph Cox about the FBI sting operation, where they ran and basically took over a massive encrypted telephone network. And he told that story. That was like just such an awesome and riveting story. And then that went right into introducing another friend of mine, Emma Best, from the Distributed Denial of Secrets, who talked about the co-option of hackers by intelligence agents and government and other government agents in particular, and why the hacker community should not be so easily led astray by the government to do things that the government wants that are not necessarily in our interest. And then that led right into another just absolutely amazing and really riveting talk, which was by John Kiriakou. And he and I didn't know each other beforehand, but it turns out that John Kiriakou, who was a very high-ranking CIA official who then became a whistleblower, well, he and I actually wound up, we were at CIA at the same time. We knew a lot of the same people, and he told me before the talk that he had written a very unflattering obituary of my former boss when he had passed away. And so it was one of these crazy things. And his talk was just, I think, extraordinary. I've never heard anything like it. He had no slides. He was just using the power of his words to convey an incredible story, an incredible journey. And I think the entire audience there in Marillac, which was, I think, one of the largest auditoriums in Hope, was just completely riveted to that screen. So I had a great time doing that. That was different for me. Sadly, I had to leave early on Sunday, though, because so I didn't see the ICE talk, and I didn't get to watch the closing ceremonies. So I wanted to ask you about that, Emmanuel. How was the closing ceremonies?
You mentioned our friend Greg, and it was quite emotional because as people may not know, but of course if you attend, hope you do know now, that Greg is battling pancreatic cancer, and it's just a gut shot for all of us to have something like that happen, to have somebody that is such a vital part of the organization, of this program on many occasions of the hacker community, to have somebody go from being completely healthy to that so quickly. It also makes you realize how tight this community can be, because he was part of the closing ceremonies and the entire crowd made it clear that he was in their thoughts. And I think he felt really good about that, but I'm sure we'll have him on. I'm sure we'll talk to him and wish him all the best. We had another talk that was kind of surprising, kind of controversial. In fact, many of our talks are controversial, obviously, at hacker conferences. But this one had somebody who was formerly from Doge. And, you know, there are people who think that you shouldn't ever have anybody who is ever affiliated with Doge on, but what better way to find out some things that maybe Doge doesn't want you to know? Turns out this guy, okay, I don't know who that is, but don't do that again. turns out this guy still seems to have some allegiance with Doge, just insofar as defending what they stood for. Now, the way this talk was put together, we had a journalist, Adam Klasfeld, speaking with the former Doge engineer, name of Saeed Levinja, is I believe the way to pronounce it. I'm just going to play an excerpt from that because it really was fascinating, and a lot of people seemed to get something out of it.
Meaning. What was your understanding of who Amy Gleason was in the chain?
Well, she was like the acting head of USDS, right? So the EOs explicitly sort of refer to that position, but she wasn't really involved in like any of the Doge, like the sort of Trump Doge Elon stuff.
Mm. One of the reasons that I ask, there's, you know, my background, I mentioned I'm a legal journalist, and there are a couple of live cases going on right now about that go to the appointments clause, which is basically the constitutional mandates of how an agency is created, how someone heads an agency. And a question that has come up, and legal journalists have asked this question over and over again, who is the administrator of Doge? And who, during your time, would have been the boss?
Well, there's no boss. I mean, I was working as senior advisor to chief of staff in VA, and I was asked to help the agency execute the EOs that Trump signed.
Mm-hmm. But your understanding of who you reported to?
Like, well, but what is reported? Like, what does that mean? Like,
well,
I'm not like the federal government is very interesting because, like, in a typical company, you have like a manager, but in the kind of the context of the U.S. federal government, it's actually incredibly flat. Like, because Congress defines statutory roles. But I was an advisor to the chief of staff, okay. Right? So, like, if I had a boss, it was the chief of staff of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Like, if he said you can't do this or you should do this, like, that's my job to help him run the org, right?
Got it. But
and he was nominated, I believe, appointed by Trump.
Right. So I think, you know, what you're saying and what is often the kind of live issue being litigated here in a couple of these cases is there's a presentation of Doge of, oh, we're just advisors. Then there's the perception of Doge that Elon Musk was in the White House. He tweets out CFPB RIP, and then the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau they try to shut it down. And it's a kind of question of...
I think he was just being a whistleblower in that context.
What's that?
He's just a whistleblower.
That Elon Musk is.
Well, if he's saying CFPB RIP, right, he's just sharing private information with the public.
That he wasn't at that point... You're saying that he wasn't having a role in shutting it down?
No, and correct, yeah.
That he made he had a similar comment. I'm trying to... he said with... USAID. We are in the process of shutting down USAID.
Yeah, the royal we, like Trump and Marco Rubio and Russ Vought.
So from your vantage point, this was just Elon Musk informing the public.
Well, I mean, you know, in political theory, you have like the concept of scapegoats, right? Like Rene Girard likes to talk about. And I think Doge is like the perfect scapegoat because like at the end of the day, like who's in charge? Like Trump and the secretaries of each agency. And if Doge, like, you know the meme where, like, someone's, like, getting, like, you know, all these arrows are hitting somebody and, like, there's someone, like, defending them? That's, like, Elon, like, taking all the heat, right? I don't know why he was so interested in doing that. It's kind of, like, goes back to why he called it Doge. I think he likes being the center of attention and he likes, like, the sort of, like, the conflict of that, which most people do not like. I think USAID was going to get shut down no matter what. Part of Project 2025 or whatnot. Doge was happy to take the credit, and Trump was obviously happy to let them. So genius like political strategy by the Trump admin.
Mm.
And by the media for, by the way, supporting it completely. They've done a very good job of like making Doge feel super powerful, even though we have literally zero authority to do anything besides be an advisory body, which is why the lawsuits won't go anywhere, why none of the people doing the lawsuits have ever asked me, who's on the record of saying all these things, to like do an affidavit or anything. No one really cares. No one really believes that there's a problem here.
And
I mean, there is a problem, but like the people in power aren't really willing to do much about it.
There is a lot there just in that 5-minute clip. Basically, this guy, first of all, he is referring to himself as being part of Doge still to this day, even though he was fired from Doge. But to say that he doesn't report to anybody, or didn't report to anybody, didn't really have a boss. People pretty much were doing what they wanted to do in that organization. And that those in high power didn't really care what was going on. you know, I think what this Doge talk with which basically had this guy being interviewed by Adam Klasfeld, a renowned journalist, it's an hour of slow social engineering, you know, where this guy is revealing things that ordinarily I don't think he would think is a good idea to reveal, but with a skilled reporter just basically chipping away at some of the things that this guy is saying and depending on his own arrogance to come back and clarify certain remarks. I think a lot is here. A lot is revealed. And I hope we study this. I hope we look at what is actually being said. What do you guys think?
I could jump in there and say, you know, I think a lot of what he was talking about on the record there with respect to the appointments clause and the lack of legal authority for Doge to do anything except be an advisory body was really, really right on. And it could be something that if the right lawyers were smart enough to latch on to this conversation could actually help to augment some of the ongoing lawsuits that allege that Doge has been unlawfully bypassing constitutional safeguards and the Trump administration has been engaging in massive amounts of executive overreach. And this is quite literally from the horse's mouth. So I think that the implications of that particular talk could be felt much, I think, for quite a long time. I think that there could be, I think, tremors coming from that talk for quite a while, because it was there was a lot of rather important information, I think, that came out.
Rob?
Yeah, I also think it's an important conversation to have had, because even if you don't agree with the things this person is saying, it is very important to know what he's saying, because what he's saying is what they're thinking behind the scenes of the thing that, you know, perhaps is worth fighting against, is worth pointing out how ridiculous the fact of it is. Information is light. Information is power. And information, even from somebody who's talking a load of crap, can be very, very helpful and useful in making things better.
Yeah. And, you know, it's true what they say, that sunlight is the best disinfectant. So having the opportunity, and it appears that this guy was so excited to have the opportunity to just spell this line of just utter hogwash. I am sorry, but if you if you're going to say with your whole chest, oh yeah, he's a whistleblower, it helps to know what a whistleblower is.
Yeah, Elon Musk is a whistleblower. That resonated. That was something.
Like, I almost didn't hear what came after it because I was so taken aback by that. If you're going to say something like that with your whole chest, know what you're saying. I think that this is a lot of the reality televisionification of so much of our culture, and now it has gotten to the highest offices in the land. But also, if you're in a position and you don't know who you're reporting to, you were probably not a great employee, claims of transparency aside.
Or the organization was not a great organization. I think that's a lot more likely there. Kyle, you were tasked with asking questions that came in from the internet. So you actually got to face off directly with a former Doge person and probably a present Doge person too, from the way he was speaking. What did that feel like? Did you feel like you were coming up to the face of darkness or something? Just, I mean, wow.
That's a very good question. It was a new position, new task that I had taken on. And, I will say there were a lot of questions that we didn't get to that we wanted to get to. And when I was looking to my left at the microphone, there were like 10 people lined up. It just seemed like a huge amount of interest in people doing their own clarification and follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. But it was very odd. I want to actually hear a bit, or I'll definitely go back and watch more of the beginning part of that, because I hadn't heard some of those other insights that the interviewer had drawn out of the speaker. So for me, it was very weird to have this person give me a one-word answer for something. It felt like a cop-out or something, and they seemed a little bit like jaded and were really taking a long time to not really give much granular insight, and so we didn't really get the answers we wanted. I think everybody was left a little bit unsatisfied in one way or another with what was said, but there were things between what the lines, I think, that a lot of people noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it, it just wasn't, I was left unsatisfied with some of the answers that I got, at least to the questions that I was fielding from our virtual attendees. But we wanted to take some time and try to get to it, and there was just, it I think was said afterwards, this could have been a much longer talk. We should have maybe accommodated. If had we more time, we probably would have had even more interesting findings in it. But it's what we could do. We did our part to learn more about this person's experience, and I'm really proud of people taking it on and coming up with insight to try to have this person think about a little bit more about their role. But it was quite telling.
Well, I was very impressed with the audience just listening. In fact, he even thanked them for listening. But I think it speaks more to just how people are willing to hear something that might be really horrible sounding to them, but at least let it be said so that there is something to counter, something to debate. And I think that's what happened here. I wish it could have gone on for longer. I really do. There was no way to know just how talkative this guy would be. Turned out he was quite talkative. But I think what was said in the time that was allocated certainly is significant. And I think it'll evoke a lot more questions.
Yeah, I hope people do ask some more questions. And just as we uncover more about this agency or non-agency, I don't even think we got a good answer on that, but it would be nice. It felt like the appearance was going to be revealing, but no one really heard a lot of contrition. There were a lot of excuses.
I heard no contrition whatsoever.
Yeah,
I mean I didn't listen to the whole thing closely, but I really didn't hear any. Alex, any other thoughts on this? And also I wanted to ask you about Harper Reed too.
Yeah, I mean, I sadly, I didn't catch the entirety of the Doge talk. I caught the tail end of it. So, you know, a lot of this has been news that's filtered back to me after the conference. And I didn't catch the entirety of it because I was engrossed in conversation with so many other attendees. Kind of almost every time I would enter a room or exit a room, there was somebody there that was interesting and with whom I wanted to carry on a conversation. So that was why I didn't see the entirety of it. But I think this one's going to reverberate for a while. I think that there's going to be coverage about it. I think this one was going to be, a really important talk and probably one of the talks that we'll look back on in 10 years. At Hope 26, I think, at that point, and say, wow, that was pretty incredible. How did we pull this off? I mean, quite frankly, I think there's a lot about Hope that we look back at later on and say, oh my God, how did we pull that off? I think this is going to be one of those for sure. And you want me to talk a little bit about Harper Reed?
Well, in less than a minute, yes. And then Rob has some closing remarks. Go ahead.
I mean, this is a guy who was the CTO of the Obama campaign in 2012, and he came and gave us like an incredibly inspirational talk about, you know, what he did and where he was and what he's up to. And, you know, this is a guy who's like very squarely part of the hacker culture. It just mystifies me that we didn't have him on sooner. Put it that way. Over to you, Rob.
And I just want to give a shout to the listeners who showed up at the Off the Hook AMA. It's always great to get the opportunity to chat with you in real life, hang out a bit. And thank you all for listening and supporting us.
As always, yes, definitely. It means so much to actually have faces to to connect to as well. So it's always great to see people. It always is great to converse and share experiences and answer questions and just enjoy each other's company. We're going to continue talking on Channel 2600 on YouTube. That happens at 8 o'clock, just a couple of minutes from now, we will be back next week. I believe next week we're doing a call-in show on WBAI. Someone correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, we're set for that. So that means there's no overtime next week, but there's an overtime this week. Again, 8 o'clock on Channel 2600 on YouTube. We will be back next Wednesday, 7 p.m. on WBAI for that aforementioned call-in show. Until then, stay tuned to what's going on, because, boy, it's interesting and it's relevant, and you have more power than you think. Above all, you're not alone. WBAI is here, and please make sure we stay here by supporting Peace and Justice Radio. Good night.
I want your warriors.
Of wij wilden meedoen aan de Week van de Belgische Muziek, dat was een vraag die we een tijdje geleden kregen. Natuurlijk wilden we dat. Uit de vruchtbare muzikale Belgische grond konden we zonder veel moeite 16 coole nummers naar boven spitten. Goedenavond en welkom bij Signaruis. Onze muzikale Belgische trip die begint in de hoofdstad, want het trio Milk TV komt officieel uit Brussel. In de rangen vinden we echter ook Antwerpenaar Casper de Geus en die kunnen we kennen van More O'Grady en het kleine vlerklabel. Met zijn twee vrienden van Milk TV maakt hij kleurrijk en geflipte DIY knutsel No Wave. Deze single kwam eind vorig jaar uit. Anorak van Milk TV.
We'll be right back.
Golden Teeth van Baya Computer. En dat komt uit de gelijknamige tweede plaat van deze bende synthpunkers uit Doornik. Die kwam op een aantal labels uit, waaronder Ronnie Rex, het label van Radio Scorpio DJ, DJ Ronnie. Luister op donderdag eens naar zijn programma Vrije Radio Odessa. Terug naar Brussel, de all-female Dino Postpunk van Pega. Oorspronkelijk waren ze met 6, maar uiteindelijk bleven ze met 3 over. Vorig jaar brachten ze het leuke EP'tje Tompet de Chips uit. En geen moeilijk doenerij, gewoon 4 scheve nummers. Het eerste nummer daaruit is Trop Difficile van Pega.
Verspilling van tijd, doodgeboren emoties, zo'n verspilling van tijd, doodgeboren liefde, spook door mijn hoofd.
Wie heeft hem herkend? Dit was Heldenbok met Doelloze Liefde. Een stem misschien wel herkenbaar voor de trouwe Radio Scorpia-luisteraar. Gert Ruimen, de man achter dit Coldwave-project, vertoeft nu in de donkere mijnstreek, maar hij was jaren jullie enthousiaste gastheer bij het punk- en hardcore-programma Funtime Radio. Dit is zijn eerste nummer dat hij online gezwierd heeft op Bandcamp, samen met de Clubmaster-remixen van Angel Love 67. Benieuwd naar meer. En we blijven nog even hangen in de donkere weesferen met het Brusselse Particle. Het duo startte in 2019 en vorig jaar al brachten ze een eerste plaat uit. Op Related Memories laten ze ons alle hoeken van hun darkroom zien met industriële drums, analoge koude synths en diepe bassen. Doof de lichten en geniet mee van de melancholie op I'm Yours van Particle.
feeling of doubt. I missed my place on the pedestal with just a hair.